I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy.
Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I'm your host, Yannick, and today we will be discussing mental health and well-being in education. And we have a special guest with us, and I'll allow her to introduce herself.
Hi, my name's Claudia.
Claudia, so tell us a bit more about yourself in terms of like your background and your role and what you do, essentially.
So I am a social worker and a family therapist. And currently I work in East London in a role, my friend calls it the mystery CAMS role, because it is based partly in child and adolescent mental health services and partly in schools.
Growing up, I don't, you know, remember mental health even being, you know, spoken about within the classroom or in general within, you know, the school setting. So, you know, as a sort of family therapist or in your role, when did you start to notice that actually mental health is being, you know, spoken about more and more within schools, and it's actually, you know, an important thing?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not an expert on the history of it, and I think some of the work started happening before I joined child and adolescent mental health services. But there was a 2017 Green paper, which I think was actually under the Tories, and that spoke about wanting to increase access to mental health services through piloting programs that started in schools. So I know that that's when government policy started. Well, that there was a shift in government policy, presumably a little bit before then, because that didn't come out of the blue.
And in terms of your experiences, you know, growing up in school, was mental health something that was spoken, you know, about when you was in school? Like, do you recall that being a thing that, you know, whether it's the teachers or the senior leadership team were sort of putting in place to support the students?
Really good question. No. I went to an all-girls school, actually. So I wonder if, like, that makes a difference to, like, how you talk about what you feel and what you do about how you feel. Because I think it was relatively normal to, like, share amongst us. But I remember girls in my year self-harming in classes, and I remember a lot of things happening, which now probably we would take more seriously. Yeah. And as far as I knew, they were just things that happened and that people, like, talked about, that we talked about amongst ourselves, but wouldn't necessarily think of even, like, speaking to adults about, unless it was adults within our own families, maybe.
And it's interesting you mentioned that you went to an all-girls school, because I went to an all-boys school.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
So now I'm thinking, actually, because I went to an all-boys school, you know, was the narrative there that, you know, maybe boys don't, you know, experience, like, mental health issues. So that wasn't, you know, really something that was, you know, taken seriously. But, you know, fast forward, you know, 10, 15 years on, and me working, you know, as a head of year at a secondary school, I've been able to witness firsthand that actually, like, there were many boys, you know, in the school that I worked at that were experiencing, you know, mental health issues. So it's an interesting, it's an interesting contrast there, definitely.
And I think probably we have a long way to go still in understanding, like, what vulnerability, like, looks and feels like for boys and how we create accessible services for them. But yeah, and also, like, obviously we're also thinking about gender being more fluid, etc. But I think there are still meaningful differences between how girls and boys speak about things with each other and their friendships growing up. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, that sort of notion of vulnerability that you was, you know, that you mentioned, and not only between genders, but between, you know, cultures as well. So if you look at the added layers that come with that, you know, there could be difficulties and an understanding, you know, vulnerability as a boy, but then added difficulty in understanding vulnerabilities. For example, if you're a black boy, so it's, you know, the layers of gender, of culture, of, you know, race, religion, you know, all of these things definitely need to be considered. So in terms of the CAMS process, do you think schools have like a full understanding of the different services, you know, involved and the different things that, you know, are available to them?
There is work. I mean, I think we do some of this work, like trying to explain how things operate, how you do referrals, how what you need to write. I think there is work happening, trying to increase understanding in schools. I think there's probably loads more work to do. And I think that kind of knowledge gets retained by specific staff members sometimes. And so specific members of school teams will build up a lot of understanding because they're the ones writing the referrals, they're the ones following the referrals up, they're the ones liaising with mental health services when a child is open. And those staff, like through experience, will build up some knowledge of how everything works. But I think that takes time. And I think that takes... I think CAMS has work to do explaining processes to schools, because you could also make 5 referrals and never quite understand what's actually happened because nobody's kind of talked you through it. So yeah, I think there's still quite a lot of work to do. Yeah.
Do all CAMS services work the same and have the same sort of structures across the boroughs? Like not even just across the boroughs, but nationally, did it all work the same?
No, I think I don't know. Again, like I'm not necessarily important enough to know, but I'm pretty sure that every CAMS organizes its own processes in its own way. So yeah, I know if I think about 2 of the East London CAMS and what I know about how they work, they have different front door processes. Yeah. So yeah, I think it's really different. So yeah, you might learn how, and there are schools on the border. Yeah. You know, who have to refer to 1, 2, 3 different services in 3 different boroughs. And so it will be really, really hard to remember who does what in what way.
Do you feel that CAMS are able to meet the needs of, you know, the diverse community that we work with, that we work in, sorry, you know, considering, you know, ethnic backgrounds, considering, you know, religion, etc., because there's a lot of, you know, for certain cultures, for certain demographics, there's a lot of stigma when it comes to, you know, mental health services. Do you think CAMS are able to work with those communities, and what sort of things do they do, or what sort of things do they put in place to, you know, support those communities?
I think it's work that CAMS needs to do. You know, like vulnerability is hard. So feeling vulnerable is hard.
Yeah.
Caring and loving someone who is really vulnerable is really hard. Each community will have their own fears about what that vulnerability means for that child right now or in the future, and how other people are going to respond to that child on the basis of that vulnerability. And I think we have to assume that families come into CAMS with those fears and with those worries, and that a lot of that is healthy, particularly because, yeah, unfortunately, the mental health models that we have in the NHS in England, and you know, a lot of the professionals in charge of how things get delivered are not representing communities in East London and other parts of the country. We have to assume that people coming through the door are worried that we're not going to adapt things, and that we're not going to notice that things don't work for them. We have to recognise that it's work for them to have to even explain that to us. And we have to make those conversations as straightforward as possible. And all of that, yeah, that is work that we have to do. And I think there's a lot more work probably that we do have to do. And I don't want to also, there are clinicians that think that work is really, really important. And that And I do think CAMHS can be accessible to families from diverse backgrounds and religions. I guess my worry is always that those families and those children are having to do more work than a family for whom the service might have been designed in a more representative way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, that makes perfect sense. And from your experience, what is the sort of hesitation from, you know, those families, so families from like diverse backgrounds or family from like, you know, different, you know, religious backgrounds? What's the usual hesitation around the mental health service from your experience?
I can think of a few. So like, will you just label my child, and what's that going to mean for them? Does that mean they're going to be underestimated, which they might already be at risk of being, because we live in a society which unfortunately is still sexist, racist? Like, how are you going to describe my child, and will that stick with them, and will that lead to more problems? So maybe that could be one. Will you see my child the way that I see them, or will you see them through the lens of stereotypes? I guess that might be another fear that people have. There's also some like that. I think some people, I've had two parents recently who think that we medicate, and who think that we medicate using injections. Wow. So I think there's a lot of different things. Yeah, there's a lot of skepticism in a lot of different ways. Yeah, and how will you speak to me? Yeah. Will you judge me? Will you assume? Will you make negative assumptions about me? I think, yeah, I could probably go on, but yeah.
You know, we know within schools, mental health is something that is, you know, was spoken about a lot, and you know, we see schools try to implement things on like PSHE days or career days or in the lead up to like GCSEs, etc. Do you think mental health should be something that's within the school curriculum?
Yeah, so I feel a bit conflicted about this, I'm up for you, yeah, challenging me on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think, so it is normal to go through lots of different emotions in your life, and it is healthy to experience like a range of emotional responses, and particularly while you're a teenager, to learn different ways of dealing with them, some of which won't work out for you and you're going to have to adapt, and some of which will.
Yeah.
So my worry sometimes is that we are medicalizing like just a healthy range of emotions, and almost, and not like speaking enough to how as a community and collectively we can work through that with each other. So I guess my worry is that children will start to think that a normal range of emotions means they have a mental health difficulty rather than they're going through things.
Yeah.
And that they will start to think that a professional has to help them with that rather than their mom, their dad, yeah, their uncle, yeah, their auntie, their friends, their teacher,
yeah,
the people that are around them. So that's my fear. That said, like, I think it is anything that normalizes that range of emotions and highlights to children and young people that there is support available from the community and from the people around them is a good thing.
Yeah.
So yeah.
No, you made an interesting point, and I think sort of reflecting on that, I'm thinking again to, you know, when I was growing up, and also comparing that to what I see now within the education system. And you're right in saying that actually similar scenarios, whereas now those, you know, incidents or those situations are put into this bracket of, you know, so-and-so young person is going through a mental health crisis or mental health issues. Whereas we used to see that as, you know what, I've just had a crap day today. And these are the things that happen.
Yeah.
And this is how I expressed myself having a crap day. you speak to one or a few friends about it.
Yeah.
And essentially, you know, you move on. And what I feel, and this is not all the time, but when we lean greatly towards medical professionals, what you're doing essentially is you're taking away the young person's opportunity to build resilience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're taking away that opportunity for them to say, do you know what? This has taken its toll on me, but through doing X, Y, and Z, or through developing this coping mechanism or this coping strategy, I've been able to overcome it. So now I know that if something similar or the same thing happens again, I know how better to deal with it. Because if we don't do that, and it's just that over-reliance, how long are you going to have the mental health professional in your life?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And how are you going to react when that mental professional pulls away because you don't feel that you are able to, you know, cope with that as yourself, by yourself,
yeah,
as an individual? So
that, that is my worry. And I guess, I think we've moved in this direction because there was silencing and stigmatizing.
Sorry, for those who don't know, can you sort of explain what silencing is? And I'm saying those.
No, that's good.
I've got no idea what you're talking about.
Good. I think the worry was that people were so fearful of what they were like experiencing in terms of like thoughts, feelings, that they didn't share, and that sometimes like some conversation and some reaching out could have led to better outcomes for people. So we're encouraging that. But there is a flip side, and there is like a reverse extreme, which is exactly what you just described.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Okay. No, thank you for clarifying. Do you feel that schools should be responsible for mental health?
Okay, tell me if I'm not making sense this time as well. So I think, because I think two things at once.
Yeah.
I think that we are all responsible for treating each other well, including when we are, when the person sitting in front of us is distressed or not really okay for whatever reason, in whatever way. And I think we have to recognise that both we all have that responsibility, and sometimes children are reacting to something that's happening in school or at home. And so actually, rather than telling them, take that to a new person, a new professional, a stranger that you've never met, and talk to them about it and then figure out how you should cope with it, how about we create environments in which that can be resolved with the people it needs to be resolved with. So in that sense, I do think schools have to be places in which this stuff can get spoken about and can get resolved, and, you know, by, for example, helping a child see what resources they have, and helping them to feel safe and having certain conversations. And obviously, it's too much. You know, teachers can't do everything. Schools can't do everything.
Right.
And it is... And I think the women that you've interviewed already in the podcast, interviewed or chatted to, whatever, in the podcast, have highlighted the toll that it took to have to be so many things to a child at once. I think particularly it was it Eniola and Dami in the first episode.
Yeah.
So I do think we have a collective responsibility. I also think it has to be manageable.
Yeah.
I guess the question I would want to ask teachers is like, what support do you need to be the kind of teacher that you want to be, which probably includes some degree of care that is beyond delivering learning. And I think Eniola and Dami spoke about wanting to provide a level of care that was beyond just teaching. But that has to be manageable.
Yeah, definitely.
And it wasn't, and they left. Yeah. And that's sad.
And as you rightly said, it's about us identifying what support do the teachers need.
Yeah.
So they are better able to support their students, essentially.
Yeah.
Because you have teachers who are overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Over capacity.
Yeah.
Underpaid.
Yeah.
Some feel that they're undervalued.
Yeah.
And now they're having to take whatever emotional or mental, stresses that they are experiencing, and to be able to support others who are going through their own mental health issues. And essentially, it's not feasible. Mm-hmm. And it's not healthy. It's not healthy to expect, someone who's going through a lot to then be able to support someone else, who's going through a lot as well. So I guess it goes back to, the senior leaders, to the head teachers, etc., the CEOs of these, multi-academy trusts. Actually, what can you put in place for your staff, for your staff body, so that they are in a place where actually they can, essentially support these students? And on the flip side of that, when we just think about the systems, when we just look at them as a system, schools is a system. Schools are a system that's in place to provide learning.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think about mental health, like physical health, because, you go to the mental health first day training and they say to you, oh, mental health is just like physical health, but it's in your mind or it's in your emotions, etc. If you had a physical injury, even at school, what would they say tell you to do? They'll tell you to go to the hospital. They'll tell you to go to the GP. Yes, they can sort of put things in place and make amendments to be able to support you so that you're comfortable. But essentially, they send you, somewhere else to get the support, because they know actually we are not the professionals, or we are not the ones who are equipped, to be able to offer that support. So some could argue that it's the same for mental health, that schools should be seen as actually where the system that are there to provide the learning. Yes, we can support you as best as we can whilst you're going through this, but you need CAMHS, you need NHS, you need the mental health, service. So there's definitely many ways that, you can definitely look at it. So when we were speaking earlier, you highlighted a good point in that there are certain teachers, senior leaders, who have greater responsibility in working with CAMHS, because they do the referrals or they're the pastoral leads, etc. But if we consider the teachers who are not at the level, just the teachers who have these, students sort of one-to-one in class, whether it's 30. The maths double, 30-1 exactly, where it's the maths double lessons every Monday, or whether it's the music teacher that you see once a fortnight, how can we get those teachers, or what can teachers do to notice the signs that actually this young person or this student is struggling with their mental health?
I think teachers already do. I think it's about how they're understanding what they're noticing, how they're framing it, and what happens next. I think teachers know when a classroom is bubbly or if one child is not speaking. I think they pick up on those things really intuitively. And the ones that care more, and not every teacher will, and like different teachers have different skill sets, but I suspect that the teachers that care more about what happens beyond the learning probably are the ones that children will reveal more to as well. So if they can, children are really, really intuitive and smart too. So if they can tell that you care, they will show you more than they will show you if they think that you don't. Mm. So I guess what I'm saying is it's playing out whether we like it or not, and teachers are receiving it whether we like it or not. The question is what we call it and what we do about it. I think the other thing that I think is really hard is that I think you spoke in the last episode about behaviourist communication. Yeah. What I think is particularly hard for teachers is that often they're receiving this communication in this slightly confusing way. They don't know what the story is that led to that behavior happening, led to that communication happening. The communication is happening through behavior, so not with words. So they can't actually definitely interpret it. They don't have time to because they're teaching a class. I guess what I'm trying to paint out is what I think probably already happens. I don't know. I'm not in classrooms. And so if those things, if those guesses that I have are true, so that this stuff does play out and that teachers are picking it up, then I think it's about how you support teachers to read it and know what to do. And it won't always, you're right, like it won't always be their job to, you know, they're not going to pause the teaching and pull a child over and say, you haven't spoken for 45 minutes and you're normally the chattiest in the class, tell me what happened at the weekend. That's not appropriate, that's not helpful. But I guess I do think they're picking it up already. I don't think we've made that up. Yeah. So there must be something that could be helpful and that doesn't add to the burden, but actually allows them to do the job they want to do, given that they will be receiving that information about, you know, well-being and mental health through whatever communication that child has available to them that morning. Yeah. Does that make sense? No, I haven't really answered the question, but...
That does make sense. And, you know, you mentioned a good point about actually if a student has a positive relationship with a teacher, like they will go
to them.
They will go to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had that experience, you know, when I was head of year, you'd have your English teacher or this maths teacher said, you know what, the student keeps coming up, you know, to my office. I don't want to turn them away. They're going through stuff. They've let me know X, Y, and Z. I told them that I'm going to tell you, can you follow it up? But at some point, it gets too much when the student is always going to them, to them. And they may not have had training. They may not have had, you know, mental health first aid or whatever training is appropriate to be able to support a young person in those circumstances. That's why I feel it's important that all teachers have, you know, some form of training, whatever training is appropriate to, you know, support, you know, students and young people with their mental health. Why? Because we don't know who they're going to have, you know, that positive, you know, relationship with, even to the dinner ladies.
Yeah.
You know, even to the dinner ladies. At the school that I worked at, dinner ladies had a good relationship with the students. Yeah. You know, you will talk to them like, and you notice things. You know, if you're good at your job, whether you're the dinner lady or whether you're the caretaker, music teacher that just sees them once a fortnight, or the maths teacher that sees them regularly, if you're good at your job, you pick up these things. You notice actually, you know, something's not right. And I say this because when I was in school, I spent more time in the canteen than on the playground. I was putting up my hands for seconds. I don't even know if they even do seconds now in secondary school or primary school. But I'm saying that as an example of if a dinner lady came round and said to me at the time, oh, Yannick, do you want seconds? And I said, no.
Yeah.
That should be ringing alarm bells.
Yeah.
Hold on, this guy always.
Yeah.
And it's those little things. And I think I give that example of, because it's important to notice, you know, the little things. That's why I think it's important that, that everyone gets trained on it, essentially.
And also, I think people, not everyone, obviously, but as I said, like, I think the people who do want this tend to be the ones that get it from the kids because they can tell. But I think people want to be able to do that to some extent, like not to burn out, not to the point of burning out and having to leave the profession, obviously. Or not in a way, I think you spoke about, where that part of your role that you're going the extra mile for isn't valued by the organisation that you're working for. But if it can be properly supported, protected and valued, I don't think people mind it, because I think it's rewarding to be... To forge those relationships within limits and, you know, with appropriate boundaries, blah, blah, blah. But like, I think it's what pulls a lot of people into the job, as well as wanting to teach and help kids learn. Yeah.
So if we sort of rewind a bit
and
we think about COVID, how was working during COVID for you, and what sort of transition did you see in terms of like young people and their mental health during that period?
Yeah, I think people reacted to COVID in different ways. I mean, I still went to work. I had there were rotors and blah, blah, blah. I tried to put myself for, you know, I'm healthy. I didn't have to shield. I lived in a flat share where one person had to shield, but she actually chose to go and live with her mum for a period. So I was able to go to work and I did. But it was quiet. I remember being really worried, to be honest, about schools closing and, you know, limiting spread was really important. And I was really concerned. I remember seeing this graph that they sent around, and I wish I'd like taken a photo of it or printed it out or something. But they sent around this graph I've never been able to find since, and I'm sure I didn't make it up, with like the trajectory of COVID in terms of impact on health and deaths, and also impact on society. And the social impact was going to hit much later, and I was already worrying about it at the time that we were in lockdown. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it hit services, how big that impact was for kids on their social emotional development and their learning until maybe like September. When would you say? I think September 22, it felt like, oh, wow, okay, kids have really suffered and in ways that we hadn't really like necessarily prepared for. And services are under a lot of pressure, and that continues now. And it didn't impact everyone the same, but it did impact children negatively to be at home and not in school, I think.
Were you still able to see children during that time?
At the beginning, we cancelled everything apart from urgent and high priority. And then I can't remember now, but there were different... So at that point I couldn't, but there were different rules that came in at different times. And eventually we did start face-to-face work back up, I think probably like summer of 2020. And then that would just shift according to government guidelines, I think. Yeah. But I mean, anyone who was in crisis got seen and everyone else would be there. There was a kind of risk assessment process and a prioritization process and blah, 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 blah.
Okay. Okay. No, thank you for clarifying. And recently, I remember a couple of months ago, I was at work and I was speaking with a social worker about a young person, and they made a good point. And this was the first time that I had heard this point. And they said to me that, you know, sometimes a young person's behavior is not necessarily in relation to a diagnosis, but a trauma. And I thought to myself, oh, interesting. I wasn't aware that, you know, trauma can sort of manifest itself in such a way. And I just thought that if, you know, a young person or a student is showing certain signs and certain behaviours, it's just, you know, genetics is just like a diagnosis that hasn't been essentially diagnosed yet.
Mm-hmm.
How do CAMHS sort of work to differentiate what is trauma and what is an actual diagnosis?
It's such a big question. It's such a big question. I don't know if I'm going to give a satisfactory answer to this, but so autism and ADHD are patterns of behaviours, yeah? Mm. Which we think which we think children may be born with, but we don't actually know that. Like, we know what, I think what services have gotten good at doing is identifying the pattern. So this pattern looks like autism, this pattern looks like ADHD.
Sure.
No, they're not just patterns of behaviours, they're patterns of more than that. But like, we don't actually know why. Like, we don't know where that comes from. We don't know why. We don't definitely know like when it is or isn't trauma. I think children with complicated presentations and complicated lives probably really suffered from that. And there is an increasing acknowledgement that it can be both, that you both can go through things and those things can impact how you behave, and you could have autism and you could have ADHD. So I think there's less of an either or approach, but it's complicated and it's hard, and I'm sure we don't always get it right. And I'm just trying to think, because I sort of haven't totally answered your question. I think it's so case by case. And I guess if the pattern that the child is presenting with doesn't quite fit, or is more complicated than just autism or ADHD, then we're looking at still maybe those things and trauma, or we're looking at trauma. But I think this will change again. And we'll look back at this time and be like, you know, in the way that I'm looking back and being like, how could we just exclude children that have been through stuff from this process of assessment? I'm sure we'll look back and think what we were doing now was not quite right either.
Yeah. And what are some of the reasons from your experience that a child, when they've done an assessment, hasn't met the threshold? Because, you know, I've worked with schools before, I've worked with parents, and, you know, they do an application and I put a supporting, you know, statement for them, etc. And you know, more often than not, I think actually that there might be something there, and then you get a response saying actually they haven't met the threshold. So I'd be keen to know what are some of the reasons that children don't meet threshold.
Yeah, for CAMHS, like in general, like a sort of entry level referral. Yeah. What I'm thinking about when I'm speaking to a parent or a child or a colleague about whether a child might need access to mental health services is, so the main question I actually ask myself is this, so we all have emotional responses, we all have behavioral responses, we all have like disturbing thoughts and feelings sometimes. The question that I ask myself is this response proportionate to what we think might have led to it happening? So, you know, if you're going through something and you're feeling rage, sadness, anxiety, that's probably normal. Like, you can't go through things and not like, and your thoughts, feelings and behaviors not change. But if that has endured for quite a long time, or if you're just struggling with it a little bit more than anyone would want you to, or if the people around you are really unsure about how to support you through it and need a bit of help to build that up, build that support up and know what to do, then I think all of those things are indicators that you might need some extra professional help. Or I guess, and like another thing that people talk about in CAMHS is like, can you function with it or not? So if you are sat a little bit sad, but you can't get out of bed, that you might need a bit more help than someone who is a little bit sad, but can get out of bed.
Yeah.
So it's complicated and there's loads of factors, but for me, it's like, what got us here? What support do you have to deal with it? And how long has this been going on for without it really changing?
Yeah.
I guess are my key questions. Yeah.
And I also wanted to ask, CAMHS, I would say recently within the last year or so, maybe more so actually during COVID, as you know, you hear negative narrative about CAMHS, the waiting list and you know, the lack of capacity, not being able to support students and whatever else. How does this make you sort of feel? Because I know you work in your service, and sometimes the service that they can be speaking about is in a whole different city or whatever else. But it's essentially you're still representing the same, you know, system. So when you hear this sort of negative, you know, narrative, how does that make you feel? And I ask this because obviously I know you, you know, personally, and we've, you know, worked together in the past, so I know how hard, you know, you work in your role. So it'll be interesting to you know, to know how this sort of makes you feel, or not just yourself, but if this is discussions that you've had with, you know, your colleagues or your work community, like how do you guys feel when, you know, you sort of hear that narrative?
I do know that the public sector, like, I really believe in the public sector. I love the public sector. I work very hard for the public sector. It's not perfect. And yeah, like, it's not always good enough. Mm. And the experience that you have can depend on the clinician that you get. Like, it's really hard to deliver a consistent and uniform service because we're humans and your experience depends on the person that you speak to sometimes. So I accept that it's a flawed system, to be honest. There's a postcode lottery. It's different in different boroughs. You know, we have families in East London that register their GPs strategically. We have kids that go to A&E strategically. Right. They will not go to their local A&E. They will come to, for example, Royal London or somewhere else because they've heard that they'll get better care there. So yeah, it's not a consistent service, and I accept that it's not a perfect service. And yeah, we can do better. I think the thing that worries me more is stuff that I think will then like deter people from accessing it if they actually really, really need it. So long waiting list, you know, I've heard certain things about waiting lists that I do know aren't true. And that worries me because it makes me think someone won't ask for help when they actually need it. I believe in service being accessible. So that sometimes that worries me. And also it is an imperfect service. So as long as it's not deterring people from asking for support.
You see the thing with the CAMHS waiting list?
Yeah.
Which I've always been confused about is, you know, we mentioned previously mental health need, consider it as a physical health need.
Yeah.
You go and get support. If I needed physical support for my legs right now, because the pain that I'm feeling is immediate.
Yeah.
If someone tells me that I'm going to be on the waiting list for 12 months, even 9 months, like what's the point?
Yeah.
I'm going to be seen as like, what's the point for waiting for this service?
Yeah.
If what I need is immediate.
Yeah.
So I don't understand the logic.
Yeah.
I don't understand the logic because I think it's silly. I think it's stupid for someone to put a referral in to say that on January the 1st, this is what I'm going through. This is, you know, the support that I need.
Yeah.
And December 31st, 12 months has gone by and life has gone by. You've experienced so many different things. You've gone through so many different things. And then for a clinician to come and say, are you still experiencing the things that you were experiencing on January the 1st? Like it doesn't make sense. Like something needs to change. And I understand why some parents will be deterred. Think, what's the point? Let me use the school counsellor instead. Or let me go and speak to Mind. Or let me go and speak to another service who may not even be able to offer me the best support, but they can offer me immediate support.
Yeah.
So I think that's definitely something that needs to be worked on.
No, I agree. And when I was training in a different borough in South London, we would have training as a family therapist. We would have families that had been on the waiting list sometimes for over a year, and they would just be like, we're kind of okay now. We figured it out.
Yeah.
And that's not, well, I mean, on the one hand, like, you know, people are resourceful, but if they needed support then they needed support then. And if they didn't get it, then yeah, that isn't good. I think it is a worry. I think so where I work, the waiting lists are not, they're not 12 months for to be seen specifically. If you want autism assessments, they are really long. Yeah.
Okay.
And children, and like that's not, and children are in pain when that's a part of them that needs to be understood, and they are in school and they might be on the brink of exclusion.
And the final question that I want to ask, so with a new government in place, if you could speak to government now and request anything from them that will help support the children and adults mental health service to be able to, you know, deliver a timely and effective service, like what would that be? What would the recommendations be?
So this is, I mean, policy strategy is not what I'm good at, to be honest. And maybe this is, again, like not properly answering your question, but housing. Honestly, I would say look at how people are living and the impact the toll that takes and get that stuff sorted before you come to us. And maybe that's not right. Like, I'm sure people would disagree, but like housing really worries me. Cost of living really worries me. childcare arrangement, like things that people need to be able to live well, feel in a way more important than the thing that they get when it hasn't gone right. Like there's a lot of inequality in this country still. There's a lot of like oppression. There's a lot of institutional racism. I think we can't resolve all those things at once, but there are some things that can be done to address people's experiences that would actually be quite preventative. Help good teachers stay in their jobs, like give them the support they need. Don't burn out all these beautiful people that want to do beautiful work. So maybe I would think about those things. I'm sure there's loads that I haven't listed. Opportunities for like exercise, clubs after school, hanging out with your friends. Not having to move out of borough to have somewhere affordable to live, meaning that you don't access your family, who are your community. Those are the kinds of things that I like think about a lot.
Well, Claudia, thank you very much. That was amazing. That was very insightful for me, and I'm sure our audience will feel the same. So thank you very much, guys. That has been the Too Cool for School podcast. If you like this type of content, please subscribe and follow us on all of our social media pages. Thank you. Bye.